My guest is Paul Kennedy, the author of the new bestseller, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. According to Time magazine, this is the book that U.S. policymakers and pundits are currently lugging around in their briefcases. Kennedy, who is a professor of history at Yale, studied economic change and military conflict from 1500 to 2000 to chart how the interaction of these forces have affected the rise and fall of nations. This dense, detailed 670-page work is presently number two on the New York Times bestseller list. I spoke with Paul Kennedy from WAMU Radio in Washington, D.C. I asked him what it means to be a great power.
I'd make a distinction, of course, between great in a moral sense, which certain countries could be without being militarily powerful or economically strong. But traditionally, we have looked at great powers as being a composite of economic strength and military fighting capacity.
Is the United States the greatest power in the world?
It still is, using that combination of military strength and underpinning economic and technological capacity. But it is less great, less far ahead in that sense, that definition, than it was, say, in 1945 or 1955.
But how serious is it? I mean, are we dying?
No. This is a question I get asked a lot, and I have to keep saying no as if I'm some veterinary surgeon or morphologist or something. What we're talking about and what I've tried to discuss in the book is relative decline and relative rise of the great powers. And the argument in the final chapter is that the United States is now relatively less wealthy, has a relatively smaller share of world manufacturing output and gross national product than it had 40 years ago. Absolutely, most Americans are better off than they were 40 years ago, and this country is richer and in a certain way stronger than then. But relative to other countries, and relative therefore to all of the burdens and obligations the United States has had since 40 years ago, it is somewhat weaker.
Well, when I read your book, I learned this. We have two problems in the United States that have been disastrous for some other nations. Now, one of them is an overcommitment to projects overseas. What kinds of involvements did you have in mind?
I first of all want to say that if one looked at the overall record of American commitments overseas, then disastrous would be unfair. The American commitments to restore Western Europe after 1945, the defense agreements with Japan in 1951, a whole number of other ones to sustain other countries and members of the free world have surely, on the whole, been very good and very useful to the United States. But the tendency of a great power, number one world power, has been to intervene or to be drawn into an array of conflicts across the globe, some of which, as in Vietnam, some of which possibly impending now in Latin America, have not been so good for those societies with a large-scale American military presence, and in a way have had a counterproductive effect upon the American position as number one.
All right. The other serious problem for other nations was an unbalanced budget.
It's not so serious for other nations, I think, so long as the United States relies upon the constant infusion of foreign, especially Japanese monies, to cover our present yawning federal government deficit. In a certain sense, the Japanese surplus of capital pouring over here is keeping the money out of Japan and reducing its inflation, and it is supporting the United States from a recession and a major crisis. But in strategical terms and over the long term, this ever-growing reliance of the United States economy, because of its federal deficit and its need to borrow, upon foreign capital places some warning signs over its economic and fiscal future, and the lessons of history suggest that one shouldn't get into that position of being so dependent upon foreign finance.
Well, I understand that there's probably a line drawn under the word warning signs, but if we have these two serious problems, does that mean if we don't fix them, everything will completely fall apart?
I would not go that far. In the first place, let me just say that the book is, again, about relative decline rather than absolute decline. It's also not a historian's equivalent of that book which is on the market. I think it's called The Coming Collapse of 1990. Mm-hmm. It's not about the coming global strategical crisis of 1990. It is calling attention to the fact that the United States has all of the obligations in the world which it took up 30 or 40 years ago when it was much stronger relative to others. And it asks the question whether there isn't now an imbalance between the United States' share of economic and manufacturing strength and its vast overseas commitments and military capacities and expenditures on the other hand. And shouldn't we try to adjust both in the domestic sense of becoming more competitive economically, but also perhaps even rethinking the overseas commitments themselves?
Well, could the United States ever fall apart?
I can't conceive of a circumstance in which it could, and it's all things are possible. Historians are not soothsayers and forecasters, but it does strike me that the United States' social coherence and economic coherence is still considerably much better than that of the Soviet Union, and the problems that this country faces are significantly lighter than those faced by Mr. Gorbachev at the moment.
I wondered, your book made me think about what it would look like if this country did fall apart. I have trouble imagining it.
Well, so have I, and it's not something that I tried to speculate on in the final part of the book, though in that chapter called To the 21st Century, I do suggest long-term trends and long-term problems which all of the great powers face, but I don't cover any form of social disintegration or American equivalent of the fall of the Roman Empire, because I don't see that as being the problem. I think the problem is much more the growing gap between this country's capacity to sustain its overseas obligations and its shrinking economic base. And it's more in that sense that I talk about the relative decline of American power.
People study military history or they study economics as a way of finding out why countries decline. Is it unusual to combine the two things as you did?
Oh, I think so. As you may know, in the field of history, as in most other disciplines, there's been an awful disintegration into specialist subfields. So that somebody is an expert on the economic history of Prussia in the 18th century, but nothing else. Or on the military history of Bavaria in the 20th century, but nothing else. Bringing together the different parts of the subject of history, and in particular connecting the economic aspects of history with the military and strategical aspects of history, do seem to me important. And writing the occasional broad general book for a readership other than history professionals also strikes me as very important.
My guest is Yale Professor Paul Kennedy, author of The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. You've looked at this great span of time from the year 1500 through the present and even projecting into the year 2000. Now, briefly, what are a few of the patterns that you saw emerging around the world?
Well, I cover the period from 1500 to the year 2000 because it seems as if that's when, in 1500, the modern nation state takes off. That's when beginnings of a global system of power with the expansion of Europe begins. But within that global system of power, one always finds some states relatively growing, relatively increasing their share, and others declining and shrinking. And the argument in the book, I'm putting this very crudely indeed, 700 pages down to 2 minutes, is that the expansion of the great powers relatively and their contraction relatively can usually be detected, first of all, in their economic base, in the share of manufacturing output, in the share of commerce, and the share of entrepreneurship. As they grow economically, after a while they begin to expand militarily. On the other hand, if they slow down, if they become mature economies, if their growth rates begin to fall off, as has indeed happened to the United States and the Soviet Union since the 1960s, then their long-term future as military great powers may be placed in question, because you cannot sustain large defense forces year after year on a relatively shrinking manufacturing and economic base. This we can see in the case of Imperial Spain, of France, of Edwardian Britain, and these sort of tendencies are already continuing and observable in the world today in respect of the two great superpowers.
Well, what was the lesson to be learned from Britain, let's say, at one time the greatest power,
yes,
and a country that eventually gave up many of its territories?
Well, I would say twofold, because the argument in the book is a twofold one. One is about external policy, that is, how to handle your overseas commitments, whether one can possibly withdraw from some of them, rearrange them, have less in the way of obligations. And in a way, I think the British picture in the first half of the 20th century was one of relatively clever and sensible withdrawals from certain exposed areas in the Western Hemisphere, in the Far East, and parts of Africa, so that they did actually devolve some of their overseas responsibilities in order to reduce their commitments and to give their defense forces a chance of looking after the commitments which were left. The other side of the coin, and the lesson which I think many Americans are now considering as they debate the decline of Britain and the implications for themselves, is that Great Britain did not manage to deal with the challenge, if you like, of a high-tech, competitive revolution, a manufacturing revolution, in the early 20th century. It didn't put enough resources into commercial research and development. It didn't have a high enough amount of resources going into the creation of a well-trained workforce. It was producing far too many lawyers and far too many doctors and not enough engineers and scientists. Therefore, there are some things which do seem to repeat themselves in history, and the British case of its industrial decline and overtaking is one, I think, that concerns a number of commentators in Washington and elsewhere in this country at the moment.
Is, back to the United States again, is our dominance as a nation weakening because we've made mistakes, or is it happening just because other countries are getting stronger?
Both things are happening at the same time. The relative decline of the United States since 1945 in part is, of course, because of the success of the United States in helping the battered economies of Western Europe and of Japan to recover after the Second World War. So that the United States' share of, say, world manufacturing, which in 1945 was about 50% of the whole, a staggeringly high figure, was to that degree an artificial one. It was bound to come down when the economies of the other societies ruined by war recovered. But whether it should have come down so much, whether it should continue to be declining year on year because the American economy's growth rates from the 60s into the 70s and into the 80s have become less and less, is, I think, a more worrying sign of a lack of economic and manufacturing competitiveness, of a concern for consumption and conspicuous spending and borrowing rather than investment in the future. And in this connection, spending too much on consumption and spending a large amount on defense, but not spending enough on investment in the future, in terms of commercial research and development, increasing the savings ratio, increasing the flow of engineers and scientists, is a worrying part and is something that ought to concern all American citizens.
Well, who will emerge now as the real strength as this century moves toward a close?
The book argues that what we've seen over the past 30 or 40 years has been a world, a bipolar world, a world dominated by the two great superpowers of the United States and the Soviet Union. Militarily, to a large degree, it still is dominated by those superpowers. But at the economic level, what's happening is a devolution, a different pattern emerging. And I argue that what's happening is that we're moving from a bipolar world dominated by the two superpowers to much more of a multipolar world. Japan, for example, in economic terms, last year overtook the Soviet Union in total gross national product, which is, of course, one reason why Mr. Gorbachev is so worried about the Soviet Union.
So Japan's going to be a front runner.
Japan is economically extraordinarily productive, and China is growing even faster at the moment, doubling its gross national product every 7 years. So China and Japan in the Far East, according to some predictions, will be clearly ahead in size of their economies, clearly ahead of the Soviet Union, and perhaps even getting close to the United States in 20 to 25 years' time. We're talking, therefore, about at least four big powers, and we're not quite sure if Western Europe can get its act together and be a fifth big power. This is at the economic level. It's already there in shares of world manufacturing output and shares of world total gross national product. It will be some time before these economic shares of world power begin to be translated into military shares. But the pattern of history over the past 500 years, which I try to explore in the book, suggests that relative economic strength, roughly speaking, translates after some decades into relative military strength. So we are looking forward to a much more complicated world, not a bipolar world, but a multipolar world in, say, quarter of a century's time.
My guest is Paul Kennedy. He's a professor of history at Yale and author of the new book, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, Economic Change and Military Conflict from 1500 to 2000. We talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Yale professor Paul Kennedy, author of The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. You have said you feel the United States has a good chance of adjusting to problems because we're more flexible than some other countries. I wonder, though, if our political leaders, in your opinion, have enough of a global perspective, enough understanding about the world economy.
I think I would make a distinction between the present and perhaps the past few years generation of political leaders, all of whom were brought up, let's recall it, during the Second World War and immediately after the Second World War, and that is their formative political time. It's very difficult psychologically and culturally to think yourself into a new era and to appreciate that the world has changed so much. On the other hand, it does strike me when I go in and out of Washington as being a very large number of younger Republican and Democratic senators and congressmen who know the world has changed and who want to do some things about it. They will openly admit that the sort of significant structural, economic, and technological and educational changes needed to keep the United States competitive as it goes into the 21st century are difficult to carry out. But nonetheless, I think they see the size and dimensions of the problem better than an older generation of politicians did.
Yeah. You know, in the United States, we've been known to look at things in almost a we are the center of the universe kind of way. Do you think that's blinded us from seeing what's really going on?
Let me say, as a historian, if it's any consolation, that of course, is the pattern, that is the cultural assumption of the number one in world history at almost any time. The Imperial Spain and the Spaniards in the 16th and 17th century thought they were the center of the world. Your mid-Victorian Britons were sure that they were at the pinnacle of world civilization. Therefore, a repetition of that cultural attitude, that sense of superiority by American citizens is well understandable. The danger is it can blind you to the fact that other societies may be growing faster, may be more successful in their arrangements, whether they are constitutional or managerial or labor-saving or other arrangements or educational arrangements. So there's a danger in that assumption, but it's a one which has been seen many times before in world history.
Has your English upbringing and education at Oxford given you a kind of distance, you know, from the United States that's proved helpful in seeing us?
I think if you move to another country, you always have to make a certain number of comparisons, and you become rather more distant about the country you've moved from and look at it perhaps more objectively. But you also, I think, look at the country you have come to, I hope, with more objective detachment, because you were not brought up to assume all of its norms and all of its expectations. I would add further to that, though, that when I was at Oxford, my area of first specialization was the debate which went on in Edwardian Britain about whether it could sustain its number one imperial and naval and economic and colonial position. And what I was struck in writing this book, what I was struck by most was that the debate going on in the United States right now and for the past 10 years has so many resounding echoes of the sort of things which are being debated by Edwardian Britons as they tried to confront this problem of relative decline. Relative, not absolute decline.
You know, it strikes me, have you always been the kind of person who wanted to make sense of the world?
I started off like most historians in your own little patch, because your PhD has to be your patch. But I must say that I was always influenced by Oxford professors and lecturers who tried to see, you know, larger patterns in political development, who were willing to speak about bigger issues, who were not going to be very narrow specialists. And that has always attracted me, because I think that they were able to speak to more than their own profession. And this is to me is important. Historians should not abandon comments upon history, comments upon the so-called lessons of history, simply to journalists and politicians who are going to abuse the past, who are going to use history in an irresponsible way.
Yeah. Well, how about growing up, though? I mean, were you that way as a kid? Did people say to you, he always wants to know what's going on?
No, nothing like that at all. I was a normal sort of North Country English schoolboy, interested in soccer, interested in hill walking, interested in horse racing. No sort of real academic inclination until I suppose I started taking off in later levels of high school and at university, a sort of late developer.
Well, who did you write this book, Rise and Fall, for originally? Was it a kind of academic audience?
It was academic, but also a more general audience. It was, I must confess, at the beginning, it was going to look rather different from the way it has emerged. It was going to be much briefer. It was going to be a sort of essayistic set of reflections about why great powers rise and fall. And as I started making fairly sweeping comments upon the decline of Spain or the rise of the Dutch Republic, I began to lose my academic nerve and feel I better do much more reading about it and put in some more footnote references and some more facts and figures. So it grew in size. The other thing which changed was that it was originally intended much more as a history book, which might stop in 1945 or 1960, when the two superpowers were in place. That was the end of history. And yet, as I began writing the book and looking at the debate in Imperial Spain or Edwardian Britain about how to keep ahead, how to preserve your economic competitiveness, how to produce more engineers, how to avoid being overcommitted overseas, it struck me that that was so much like the debate going on in this country today, and so much like the sort of anxious debate going on in the Soviet Union today and under Mr. Gorbachev's perestroika and restructuring programs, mm-hmm. that I should not stop in 1945. History does not stop. We are still in the stream of history, and the world is changing perhaps even faster than it has done in past centuries. And it seemed to me proper that a historian should try to suggest as gently and I hope reasonably coherently as possible, the sorts of things which were bearing down on our present world and might change great power relationships in the future.
My guest is Yale Professor Paul Kennedy, author of The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. Well, here you are on the bestseller list, and I bet your publisher had a fairly small first printing arranged. How many books?
Oh, yes, he did. He thought he was taking a risk with a quite large and, for trade book, reasonably expensive one. A risk at printing, I think, 7,500 copies.
7,000?
Yes.
And you're up to selling how many at this point?
Oh, it's somewhere over 200,000 and about eighth or ninth printing, and just goes on and on and on.
So you're rich now?
I've no idea about it. By the time agents and publishers and taxman take their cut, I look forward to seeing what I am by September when some of it comes in.
Why do you think an academic book like this has hit it big? What do you think it is that everyday people are craving out there?
Well, I'm not sure about everyday people, but I now see an answer to that question, which I couldn't have seen 2.5 months ago, simply because of the whole variety of forums I've been asked to talk to. I think, first of all, that it wasn't just an academic history book because it didn't stop in 1945. The publisher would have been right to have been optimistic about 7,000 copies if it had done so.
What did it, though?
What it did was to touch upon a set of nerves which are clearly in evidence and rather frazzled in the American political culture at the moment. A large number of people, for example, are worried about the state of the educational system in the public schools. A large number are worried about how this average 17-year-old American compares with the Japanese or the Swiss or the German in terms of mathematical knowledge or technical knowledge.
So if you're worrying about some kind of deterioration, then the book might seem like an answer.
Yes, if you're worried about the federal deficit, then the book has significant historical case studies of powers who overspent themselves. If you're worried about whether the United States is carrying on too large a share of the global commitments of the free world, you may worry about the case studies or the implications from the story of overextended great powers of the past. And so I think what's happened is that this book has touched the concerns of perhaps five or six or more different constituencies. So one day I will go and talk to bankers or the stock market about the implications of fiscal turbulence and the excessive federal deficit. Another day I may be talking to manufacturers or organizations such as Rebuild America, led by Congressman Mel Levine. It's an interesting organization. You wouldn't have thought of Rebuild America 25 years ago. Now there are organizations out like that. And they are looking at the historical examples, which the book has, of societies which were number one great powers, which gradually had their economic competitiveness eroded.
Yes or no answer. Any thought of entering politics yourself?
Certainly not, no. Life as a professor at Yale, I think, is one of the most idyllic I can imagine. And going in and out of Washington in particular makes me see just how difficult it is to be a politician.
Thanks so much for joining us.
All right, thank you.
My guest has been historian Paul Kennedy. His new book, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, is published by Random House. I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air.